Again, that's Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born a coal miner's daughter.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Dispatch with NACO and Medicine for the People and Scatter Their Own, Friday, August 24th at the Oregon Zoo Amphitheater. Starting at 7 p.m., doors open at 5 p.m. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information online at zooconcerts.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, air quality in the Pacific Northwest continues to be affected by haze and smoke.
A labor strike has begun within the U.S. prison system.
And in international news, El Salvador dissolves diplomatic relations with Taiwan. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 21st, 2018. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Advisories from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality continue today, as much of the area is still blanketed in smoke. The haze is expected to last until noon on Wednesday. The air quality index in Portland is at 118, which is considered unhealthy for sensitive groups. This includes small children, pregnant women, those with heart disease or respiratory ailments, and the elderly. To the south, in Klamath Falls, the index has reached as high as 182, meaning it is harmful for everyone.
America's incarcerated persons planned one of the largest prison strikes in U.S. history. They want to put pressure on the U.S. penal system in a two-week strike that began today. Prisoners in 17 states are boycotting their assigned jobs, while others will take part in a hunger strike. The majority of participating prisons are located in the South and West Coast. The protest is about exploitative labor issues and poor prison conditions. The U.S. has the largest prison population in the world, with 2.3 inmates held within America's prisons. Prisoners plan to not report to their assigned jobs, hold all commissionary spending, hold peaceful sit-in protests, and participate in hunger strikes. The labor strike is deliberately scheduled to begin on the anniversary of the killing of George Jackson. Jackson was a black civil rights activist who was killed by a guard in 1971. The strike will end on September 9th, the day the Attica prison riots began in New York, also in 1971. The Attica riot left over 40 people dead when police stormed the prison to retake the facility. The labor strike is being led by Jailhouse Lawyers Speak, a network of incarcerated prisoner rights activists based out of the Lee Correctional Institution in South Carolina. The protest is also supported by Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, a protest-led trade group.
Leaders of the strike say it is aimed at ending, quote, modern-day slavery. Inmates are paid pennies on the dollar for their labor. Amani Sawari, a prison reform activist and spokesperson for the strike, said, quote, prisoner participation depends on their location and privileged status. If inmates are working, they can suffocate the prison industrial complex by reducing their spending. In some detention facilities, prisoners may not be working, so they might do a sit-in. It all depends, unquote. The protests are also in response to the prison riot that occurred at Lee Correctional Institution in South Carolina in April of this year. The riot led to dozens of injuries and the deaths of seven inmates. Sawari added, quote, initially a strike was planned for 2019, but the Lee prisoners wanted a now response. We want to make sure that things like this don't happen in the future, unquote. A list of 10 demands was posted on the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee website, including the immediate improvement of prison policies, an increase in prisoner wages, and the rescinding of laws that prevent imprisoned persons from receiving parole. They are also asking for more rehabilitation services and voting rights. Leah Johnson, professor of law at the University of Florida Levin College of Law, said about the event, quote, "If the strike is widespread enough, it could be effective. These circumstances, like poor labor conditions, poor prison conditions, unpaid labor, and lack of access to mental health treatment, exist seemingly behind closed doors. By going on a national strike, you pull back the curtain and it can force the legislators to act."
And now it's time for Labor History in Two with the host, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1893. That was the day that workers' rights and women's rights activist and anarchist Emma Goldman gave a speech in New York City. Emma Goldman was born in what is today Lithuania. She came to New York in 1885, where she built a reputation as a powerful speaker. In New York, she addressed a crowd of between 3 and 4,000 unemployed workers in Union Square. The country was at the beginning of a depression that would sweep across the nation. Working families were finding it harder and harder to put food on the table. By the end of 1893, unemployment would soar to nearly 20%. Undercover agents at the rally reported that Emma had urged the crowd to take bread from the capitalists, quote, by force. Goldman recounted saying, quote, "Well then, demonstrate before the palaces of the rich. Demand work. If they do not give you work, demand bread. If they deny you both, take bread." 10 days later, Emma was arrested in Philadelphia for her comments at the New York rally. She was sentenced to 1 year in prison. After she was released, Emma traveled to Vienna to study medicine. She returned to the United States to continue her lectures on workers and women's rights. She spoke out about the need for women to have access to contraception, an opinion that could arouse a backlash at the time. Emma was arrested multiple times for daring to speak out on controversial issues. In 1919, during the height of the Red Scare anti-communist hysteria, Emma Goldman was deported to the Soviet Union. Emma was a courageous defender of free speech, often called the most dangerous woman in America. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
El Salvador has announced it will cut relations with Taiwan in order to officially recognize and establish formal relations with the People's Republic of China. President Salvador Sanchez Seren said on state-run TV, quote, "After this careful analysis, I announce that my government has taken the decision to break diplomatic relations maintained until this day between the Republic of El Salvador and Taiwan, and to establish diplomatic relations between the Republic of El Salvador and the People's Republic of China," unquote. Gene Mainz, the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador, tweeted, quote, "The U.S. is analyzing the decision of El Salvador. It's worrying for many reasons, among which include a breaking of a more than 80-year-old relationship with Taiwan. No doubt this will impact our relationship with the government. We continue to support the Salvadoran people," unquote. The move represents another loss from Taiwan's diminishing pool of diplomatic partners. Taiwan is now officially recognized by only 17 countries, mostly smaller nations in Latin America, Africa, and the South Pacific. Now, China's influence in Latin America and the Caribbean is growing as the nation has made large economic investments and strengthened diplomatic relations. Some international analysts see this as a campaign to undermine Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. The Taiwanese Foreign Minister, Joseph Wu, has accused China of buying political support in El Salvador by investing in poor infrastructure. Wu argues that this investment risks creating unsustainable debt burdens for El Salvador. Wu has argued, quote, "It is irresponsible to engage in financial aid diplomacy or compete with China in cash, or even in providing illegal political money. My government is unwilling to and cannot do so," unquote. In response, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said, quote, "History will prove that establishing diplomatic relations with China is in full accordance with the fundamental and long-term interests of the country and the people of El Salvador."
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has been in power since 1986, longer than most Ugandans have been alive. He began his presidency as a freedom fighter, but is now the target of an unprecedented youth political movement. One of the leading lights of the youth movement is Bobi Wine, a popular Afrobeat singer who was elected to parliament last year. Wine and a number of his supporters were arrested last week. In response, Ugandans have been protesting in the capital, Kampala, as well as other cities, leading to one death and around 100 arrests yesterday. Journalist Ann Garrison, with KPFA Berkeley, has more on Wine and the accelerating political movement against Museveni.
Bobi Wine rose from a Kampala ghetto to become a hugely popular Afrobeat singer, much admired by Ugandan youth. This week, he and 32 of his friends were arrested in Arua, a district of rural Uganda, while campaigning for parliamentary candidate Kashana Wadri. Wadri won his election from prison. President Yoweri Museveni, who has held a tight grip on power since 1986, was also in Arua, campaigning for Wadri's opponent. This is a passage of Bobi Wine's song, Freedom, which he recorded in 2017, the same year he was elected to Uganda's parliament.
We are fighting for freedom. Musi amalaba, mutukula chotera. We are fighting for freedom. Nebi bakwa chimoroto chatundu. We are fighting for freedom. Badel masindi, kabung karamoja. We are fighting for freedom. Oi machiriandongo, poti wundi wujo. We are fighting for freedom.
Bard College professor Helen Epstein, who spent decades researching public health in Uganda, wrote about the context of Bobi Wine's arrest on the website of the Vanguard Africa Foundation. Quote, Bobi Wine's most recent ordeal has been unfolding under the horrified gaze of thousands of fans on social media. Youth in his neighborhood rioted on Thursday and Friday. On Friday, the U.S. Embassy and European Union finally issued a statement expressing concern about the events and urging the Ugandan government to respect its own constitution, but neither suggested that Museveni's government would suffer any consequences for their actions. In order to understand the muted tone of these statements, and no doubt the others to come, it is important to know that Museveni is probably the West's strongest military partner in Africa. Ugandan troops are fighting on behalf of the U.S., U.K., and EU in Somalia, as well as serving as guards alongside U.S. troops in Iraq. What is more, France is training Uganda's army along the border with Congo, and Ugandan troops are also reportedly preparing to join the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Unquote. The U.S. is the number one bilateral donor to Uganda. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA and Afrobeat Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
Since 1973, Oregon has maintained a statewide program for land use planning. As part of this program, state law requires each city to adopt a comprehensive growth plan and the zoning laws needed to put it into effect. Portland's most recent comprehensive plan defines a new type of so-called middle housing and would potentially upzone all of Portland's residential neighborhoods. Some neighbors are crying foul. KBOO's Joe Meyer is covering the issue and filed this report.
Portland's comprehensive plan was passed by City Council earlier this summer. Now, the Multnomah County Neighborhood Association is organizing to appeal the plan. For more, I spoke with planning consultant Eben Foder.
Comprehensive planning is supposed to be done with lots of information. You gather facts about the situation, the community, the demographics, the needs, the desires of the community. And then you draft policies, goals and policies, and then ultimately you implement them. But, you know, in this instance, it was rather free of public engagement. And I think that's where, you know, the middle housing policy just kind of appeared out of nowhere and is a transformative policy, because what happens with the middle housing policy is it authorizes the city to go and essentially densify or, you know, increase the density of single-family homes, single-family neighborhoods that previously were just single family and allowed for one home, and now a home and an ADU or an accessory dwelling unit. But this allows, the policy allows the city to go considerably further and encourages them to do so. So now we have the residential infill project, and that is, currently looking at rezoning, upzoning about 60% of the city's single family homes. And potentially it could be expanded to all homes. And you know, that would be an easy step and maybe a step that they do in the near term.
Who at the city is advocating for middle housing?
Well, I think that, you know, the primary advocates were the, you know, previous mayor and a couple of the city commissioners who are no longer with the city. So, you know, I think some of the main advocates have left. You know, there are still a couple ardent advocates in the city, but I don't see, you know, that there's really a base of support, you know, amongst the public or, you know, the community. It seems to be coming from some specific sources, perhaps development interests, folks that are interested in you know, getting into redevelopment.
You mentioned it was sort of rushed in. Can you go through the timeline? Is it a many-year process typically?
This process started started in 2009 and wrapped up in 2016. You know, you're looking at a seven-year period. But what happened is, you know, it's supposed to be an orderly process, and as I say, you gather information. And then you formulate a plan based on that information. So it's, you know, evidence-based, factual-based, public process-based. But what happened here is that the middle housing policy was implemented, was introduced in April of 2016. And then the plan was adopted officially and finally by the council in June of 2016. So just a couple of months. And the thing about this policy is because it is, you know, it has such significant repercussions, it really should have gotten a lot of, you know, public process instead of almost no public process. So what you have is essentially the most significant part of the comprehensive plan, of the entire comprehensive plan, being introduced at the last minute.
Land Conservation and Development Commissions is citizen-based, so what went wrong there?
Well, you know, they are, you know, appointed members. And I think, you know, they're appointed maybe from a certain perspective, you know, not necessarily a community or citizen or neighborhood perspective. Some of them are from more, you know, development and business orientation. So I think in spite of the fact that they are volunteers, they may not be especially sympathetic to neighborhood issues.
Do you see any statewide implications if this stands?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it's first of all, you know, it's a citywide issue for Portland. It'll affect Portland immediately, but it'll affect, you know, it has statewide land use planning implications because I think the public support for the land use program is based on the fact that we believe as citizens that we are going to be engaged, that we have a voice. And I think what this decision shows, that the rejection of all our issues, is that, in fact, we don't have a voice, that, in fact, the city can do whatever it wants, regardless of how much citizen input there is, of the tenor of the citizen input. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's very worrisome. So if citizens are not required to be involved, and that the comprehensive nature of the planning process is not required either, because the city can do this kind of last-minute introduction of a major policy change and really not figure out whether, for example, the road's going to be adequate, or is there enough school capacity. So all those things have not entered into the planning process and were not part of the final comprehensive plan. So that really undermining the quality and character and confidence that we have in the land use planning program that's really shaped Oregon and has, you know, kept cities fairly compact and kept our rural areas beautiful and provided for, you know, a sensible, orderly, you know, information-based planning process.
Will it make housing more affordable?
The short answer to that is no. If you have a, you know, a good job with a good salary, then you can afford a middle housing unit. That's, you know, they're going to be market rate units. So I don't see it helping the, you know, categories of housing that where it's really needed. So that's really the low income, the very low income, and the homeless are the categories that we really need to pay attention to, as, you know, local governments need to be paying attention to. I don't think they need to be helping out people that, you know, have good jobs and good salaries, because that's really where middle housing units are going to be built to you know, the market demand, and it'll tend to be expensive, you know, newer, upscale units. You know, the first thing that would happen here is that, you know, once you have this middle housing policy and you allow lots of units to go, say 4 units to go on every residential lot, which is what they're currently considering, then you create a really profit potential for developers, big developers, even international developers, to come in, buy up every affordable, low-priced unit, single-family unit. So those are going to be wiped off the market immediately. Bulldozers will come in and they'll get the treatment. So I think that what you're going to see is just is a real loss of some of the nice, affordable, smaller single-family homes. Those will be gone very quickly. And then gradually they'll work their way up to, medium-priced homes in terms of reprocessing those into, multiplexes.
Who benefits?
That's a good question. I'm still struggling with that myself because, I can see it. There's a few local developers who might benefit, but other than that, I don't really see a lot of beneficiaries.
Okay, anything else for our KBOO listeners?
This is an issue to pay attention to, and if you're concerned about it, get in touch with the Multnomah Neighborhood Association and offer some support because the clock is ticking. And I think if this appeal, if they're able to make this appeal, it could be very important, I think, to establishing the credibility of the land use program.
Thanks so much for talking to KBOO.
Thank you, Joe.
That was Eugene-based planning consultant Eben Foder. He told us that Portland's new middle housing policy was an 11th-hour addition to the comprehensive plan, that development interests subverted the public process, and that the proposed residential infill plan will likely lead to further destruction of affordable housing in favor of market-rate housing. You don't have to go to Washington to fight for clean public process and fight against corporate corruption of government. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
The Terwilliger fire, which is burning east of Eugene, has grown to around 125 acres and is 0% contained as of Tuesday morning. The wildfire ignited on Sunday near the popular Terwilliger Hot Springs. This is the first major wildfire of the season in the Willamette National Forest. A morning fire report from local officials said, quote, "The weather will challenge firefighters today. An offshore flow will produce easterly winds with gusts of up to 30 miles per hour. These windy conditions are forecast to continue throughout Wednesday." Officials said the high winds mean the fire is likely to grow to even larger and be difficult to suppress. Around 87 firefighters, helicopters, engines, and dozers are working on containing the blaze. Responders include teams from the Oregon Department of Forestry as well as the U.S. Forest Service. The fire is burning on both sides of the Cougar Reservoir. Recreation areas near the reservoir has been closed due to the fire. This includes hiking trails, lookouts, campgrounds, as well as the entirety of the Terwilliger Hot Springs. Willamette National Forest spokesperson Chiara Schiprano said, quote, "We have a lot of other recreational areas in the McKenzie River corridor we are directing people to, including Proxy Falls and McKenzie River Trail." The fire ignited so quickly that it nearly trapped around 20 people visiting the hot springs. Robert Noble and his 10-year-old son ran through a wall of flames right as it began to engulf the trail. Noble said, quote, "We were just soaking and having a great time when all of a sudden somebody came running up the trail and said, 'Hey, there's a fire and you need to evacuate.' We just started running. The fire had just started to cross the path when we got there. We put our towels over our noses and mouths and ran through the flames that were 4 to 6 feet tall. Looking back, we could see the fire running up the mountain. I knew it was going to get big because it was just so dry in there." Officials said they successfully evacuated everyone from the hot springs without serious injury. Currently, no residential areas or structures are threatened by the fire, and no evacuation notices have been released. The Forest Service also wants to remind visitors that all campfires outside the designated campgrounds are banned in the Willamette National Forest.
Some of the oldest and thickest sea ice in the Arctic has started to break up. The area, which is north of Greenland, is normally completely frozen over, even in the summer. This is the second time this year that warm winds and climate change-driven heat waves have affected the region. The area is normally so frozen, it was referred to by scientists as the last ice area. They had assumed it would be the last frozen area to withstand the melting effects of a hotter planet. However, temperature spikes in February and August have left it vulnerable to warm winds. The winds have pushed the ice further from the coast than at any time since record-keeping began in the 1970s. Some meteorologists think this could force scientists to revise theories about which part of the Arctic will withstand warming the longest. Ruth Mottram of the Danish Meteorological Institute stated, quote, "Almost all of the ice to the north of Greenland is quite shattered and broken up, and therefore more mobile. Open water off the north coast of Greenland is unusual. This area has often been called the last ice area, as it has been suggested that the last perennial sea ice in the Arctic will occur here. The events of last week suggest that actually the last ice area may be further west.
And now from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. In today's episode, hydropower in California.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. On hot days in California, people turn on their air conditioners, and demand for electricity spikes. Winter is a distant memory, but the snow that fell then helps the state meet its energy needs now. That's because in California, much of the water used to produce hydropower comes from melting mountain snowpack.
The snowpack provides a great storage reservoir up at a high elevation to hold back potential water that could then feed into a powerhouse or into a turbine. We also have small lakes and reservoirs all along the High Sierra.
That's Sarah Yarnell of the University of California, Davis. She says hydropower is an important resource.
Because we can turn it off and on exactly when we need it, assuming that the water is stored up high, either in the snowpack or in a reservoir up high.
But that resource is dwindling.
We're below average on our snowpack this year. Not as dire as it was in 2014 and 2015 when we virtually had no snow in the high elevations, but we do have a low snowpack this year.
As the climate warms and snowpack declines, hydropower plants will have a harder time meeting the state's electricity needs.
These are things that we'll need to take into account as we assess our energy needs into the future.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
CurrentCast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, how hotels can save water.
The Water Sense Hotel Challenge on this CurrentCast.
Hotels and other lodging businesses account for about 15% of the water used in commercial and institutional facilities around the country.
That's Tara O'Hare of the Environmental Protection Agency. To help hotels conserve, the EPA launched the WaterSense Hotel Challenge, a program that provides best management practices and tools. Some of the recommended techniques include checking the facility for leaks, using drought-resistant landscaping, establishing a towel and linen reuse program, and upgrading shower heads, faucets, and toilets to WaterSense-labeled fixtures. The result is a win all around. By greening their practices, hotels will save green on their water bills. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at CurrentCast.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview about Mercy Corps working in the Democratic Republic of Congo to contain a recent Ebola outbreak. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, it's Calculated Conversations. Tonight's weather will be partially cloudy with a low of 63 degrees. Tomorrow will also be partially cloudy with a high of 94 degrees. Areas of smoke and haze continue to blanket the region. Today in history, in 1911, the Mona Lisa was discovered missing from the Louvre Art Museum in Paris, France. Vincenzo Perugia, a former employee, entered the museum, removed the painting from the wall, and walked out with it hidden beneath his clothes. It took detectives over 2 years to find and return Leonardo da Vinci's famous painting to the museum. The quote of the day is from civil rights activist George Jackson, whose today's national prison strike commemorates. Patience has its limits. Take it too far, and it's cowardice.
Now it's time for the Middle East Minute Plus. On today's episode, the bomb that killed 40 Yemeni children was found to be U.S.-made.
This is the Middle East Minute Plus, and I am Sophia Armin. Thanks to the work of journalists at the online Chicago-based publication Electronic Intifada, the Israel lobby group J Street has withdrawn its endorsement from Rashida Tlaib. A statement on Friday by J Street read, after closely consulting with Rashida Tlaib's campaign to clarify her most current views on various aspects of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we have come to the unfortunate conclusion that a significant divergence in perspectives requires J Street PAC to withdraw our endorsement of her candidacy. The Electronic Intifada confronted the to-be congresswoman over her ties with the group. Tlaib made history earlier this month as she is likely to be the first Muslim woman and the first Palestinian-American elected to the U.S. Congress in history. CNN has reported that the bomb that killed 40 children when it struck their school bus in a Yemeni northern city was made by the U.S. weapons manufacturer Lockheed Martin and sold by the United States to Saudi Arabia. The August 9th airstrike killed 51 people total. The bomb, a laser-guided MK-82, is similar to other U.S.-manufactured bombs that struck a Yemeni market, killing 97 people, and a funeral home, killing 155 people, in 2016. The killing of the 40 children has sent shockwaves around the world, with activists calling on superpowers to disarm and demilitarize. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Saudi Arabia is about to execute a female political activist for the first time. 29-year-old Isra Al-Ghamgham has been imprisoned in Dammam's Al-Bahabith prison since 2015. She and her husband were arrested in a night raid on their home following anti-government protests in the eastern region of Qatif. Qatif is predominantly Shiite area in the majority Sunni Muslim nation. The protests accused the Saudi government of discrimination against Shiite Muslims and demanded the release of political prisoners. Al-Ghamgham, along with five others, including her husband, were charged with organizing anti-government protests and, quote, inciting disobedience of the ruler. During her first trial session earlier this month, the prosecution recommended that Al-Ghamgham be sentenced to death for her crimes. The court has yet to convict her, and the trial is not set to continue until the end of October. The director of the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, Ali Adubizi, said, quote, sentencing a female human rights activist defender to death is a dangerous precedent for Saudi Arabia. It's largely a revenge against the Arab Spring and punishment for Qatif, which witnessed the largest protests since 2011. Since 2015, Saudi Arabia has executed seven women for crimes such as murder. However, they have not sentenced a female political activist to death. According to Amnesty International, in total, Saudi Arabia executed 146 people in 2017, up from 90 in 2015. Sarah Lee Whitston, the Middle East director of Human Rights Watch, said, quote, any execution is appalling, but seeking the death penalty for activists like Isra Al-Ghamgham, who are not even accused of violent behavior, is monstrous. Every day, the Saudi monarchy's unrestrained despotism makes it harder for the public relations team to spin their fairy tale of reform to allies and international business.
Indigenous rights activist and water protector Tia Chacombe, also known as Tracy Molina, held a news conference today in front of City Hall as she prepared to attend her day in court. Molina was brutally arrested during the August 4th demonstrations versus Patriot Prayer in downtown Portland. This is what she had to say to the Portland police and Police Chief Danielle Outlaw.
Wally Kinasic, good afternoon. My name is Tracy Molina. I'm Shishimik Nawa Mashika. I was raised in Siletz, Oregon. I'm going to ask you to bear with me. I'm new to this. I'm not good at public speaking. I didn't ask to get drafted into this. You know, this arrest, that how I was arrested here in Portland, has drafted me into doing this, and I really feel like we have a message that needs to get out. But first, I want to acknowledge this land. Here we're standing on Chinook land. I want to acknowledge the sacred life energy we all carry. I want to pay respect to this land right here we're standing on. The blood and bones of tens of thousands of years of Chinook people's ancestors are under our feet. Their blood and bones are woven into everything that grows here. The Chinook people's earth energy is still here. There are people from these Chinook districts that still live here today. They've intermarried into many nations, but they are not extinct. Many Chinook people
here in Oregon were removed to the Siletz Reservation and the Grand Round Reservation. My oldest daughter and my son are enrolled members of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz and also have blood from the Confederated Tribes of Grand Round. These are the communities that raised me. I'm here today because I was arrested for standing up to white supremacy and those who sympathize and tolerate white supremacy. I'm here because I have court today based on ridiculous allegations against me. I don't need to say much about my arrest because it's all on video for millions of people to see what happened. I'm not here for myself. I want to address the fact that hundreds of civilians were attacked by the police force, a police force they pay for, a police force that's supposed to protect its citizens. And I have a message for Chief Outlaw. This was no schoolyard fight. I've never seen a schoolyard fight that shoots a bomb into another human being's head. Never. I don't know, maybe she's right. Maybe we could use this analogy of a schoolyard fight, because schoolyard fights are often started by bullies, and no one was the bigger bully than the Portland Police Department that she controls. No one should have to die because people are in the streets holding ground to protect their city. We paid for these streets, and some of us have paid for these streets with the blood of their ancestors. Chief Outlaw calls going to the hospital to treat third-degree burns whining. Chief Outlaw calls going to the emergency room with a potentially fatal head injury whining. No one who thinks this way should have this much power and control. She says she calls shots down the middle. The middle would mean you don't name call the groups defending itself against violent Western chauvinists. To me, there is no middle ground when it comes to defending marginalized communities. Chief Outlaw wants to wield these colonial rules of law and order over us with just as much brutal force as her white male predecessors. We did not stand in our streets with the intent to cause harm. We stood in these streets because there was no room for us, because this city government does not make room for us. We stood in these streets in self-defense. We stood in the streets to counter the message coming from Western chauvinist alternative facts. We stood in these streets because these are our streets. Portland should never hire a police chief that is not patient. There is no way you're being neutral, as evidenced by your crowd control crew shooting retreating civilians almost two blocks away. Is it neutral to not allow us in the park? If they would have allowed us to have some free speech space in the park, this all could have been avoided. The Portland police, over the loudspeaker, have given orders at many protests. And last year, we listened to those orders right here in this park. And when we listened to the orders, they attacked us anyway. They told us to go to the middle of the park, and when we went to the middle of the park, they shot us.
For KBOO News, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
Black History 365 celebrates black achievements and honors moments in black history for each day of the year. In today's episode, the first black female major in the Women's Army Corps.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is August 21st. On this day in 1943, Harriet M. Waddy became the first black major in the Women's Army Corps. She was one of the two highest-ranking black officers in the Women's Army Corps during the Second World War and its wartime advisor on racial issues. She stepped into the limelight in 1943 by making a radio broadcast urging black women to join the armed forces.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. BAM 365, where you find every day black history is made.
Two of President Trump's former associates ran afoul of the law today as Trump's longtime attorney and, quote, fixer, Michael Cohen, pled guilty on 8 counts of wrongdoing. And former Trump presidential campaign manager Paul Manafort was convicted, also on 8 counts. Cohen admitted in a plea bargain to illegal campaign contributions in the form of hush money paid to two of Trump's alleged lovers. He also admitted to tax evasion and 5 other crimes. Manafort was convicted by the jury of bank and tax fraud charges. The investigations and trials of both men emanate from referrals from the Office of Special Counsel Mueller. The admissions and convictions put them in the position of adding to the credibility of the Russiagate inquiry. Cooperation with Mueller's investigation could possibly allow them reduced sentences. Each of Cohen's convictions could carry a 65-year sentence, and Manafort faces similar penalties. This is widely viewed as a very bad day for President Trump, as both men, particularly Cohen, were intimately involved with Trump's actions and procedures. They may be able to reveal a great deal to Mueller and to any ensuing impeachment trial. Trump reacted in his typical fashion, using Twitter to launch imprecations, insults, and misdirection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Joe Meyer, Teresa Mitchell, and John Rainmiller. The producer tonight is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Mike Fatakalis. The interim directors of the Evening News and Public Affairs Directors are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, and 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River and 91.9 FM. Stay tuned after this newscast and in-depth report. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland. At 9, Project Censored discusses the way internet titans like Facebook and YouTube are censoring what users can post. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Recovery Zone welcomes Ceasefire Oregon and Students for Change to discuss gun reform efforts. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on donate. Good night, Kyle. Good night, Mike.
Good night, Yasmin. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
An outbreak of the Ebola virus officially began on the 1st of August in an eastern province in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC. As of yesterday, 50 people have died and 2,000 people are potentially affected. One of the international non-governmental organizations working to help contain and mitigate the effects of the outbreak is Mercy Corps. Mercy Corps is based in Portland, and their deputy country director for the DRC, Whitney Elmer, is in town for an event tomorrow at noon for the Mercy Corps headquarters to educate the public about the crisis. Elmer was able to stop by yesterday to speak with KBOO reporter Sam Bowman, starting with her personal history in humanitarian work.
I've been with Mercy Corps for just over 9 years now. My background's originally in public health, and then I got more kind of generally into international development. I've been in Congo now for about 2 years, and I've worked previously in the West Africa context, Niger and in CAR as well. So issues are somewhat similar to some of the other countries in which we work, but it's definitely a unique time in the Congo right now. You know, they're going through some political struggles, political uncertainty, and then on top of that, some of this kind of longstanding conflict. And more recently, you know, there's been the Ebola outbreak. So it's definitely a challenging context.
And I think I was seeing that the current outbreak began on the 1st of this month, August.
Yeah, so there were suspected cases that were reported at the beginning of this month. And so, again, they were confirmed, and we're just kind of in the early stages of the response. And, you know, it's a situation where on a daily basis there's updated information, newly suspected cases. So I think right now there's about 100 cases that are suspected. 50 people have died so far, but they're estimating that roughly 2,000 people may have come in contact with those suspected cases. So, yeah, it's certainly evolving on a day-to-day basis right now.
Could you just set the scene a little bit for us? So this is happening in North Kivu, entirely within North Kivu?
So it's in the northern part of North Kivu, which is one of the provinces in the most eastern part of the country. It borders Uganda and Rwanda.
Okay. And obviously the political situation there is extremely complex, especially in that region. You mentioned the conflict that's ongoing there, and without getting too much into the rebel factions and everything, what is the basics of that conflict currently?
So over, I'd say, the larger part of the last two decades, there's been ongoing conflict throughout the eastern provinces in DRC. You know, and there's a number of very small factions or small factions of different groups that have similar interests. You know, they're fighting over resources, access to land, power. Congo is a country that's extremely rich in natural resources, and so that's often, you know, at the basis of some of these conflicts and these tensions. And you know, again, there's kind of a lack of political oversight in some of those parts of the country. It's a very large country as well. You know, I think it's about two and a half times the size of Texas.
Wow.
So geographically, it's very vast. There are parts that are very difficult to access. Roads, you know, there's not always, you can't access parts of the country because the roads are so degraded. So again, it's easy for these groups to sort of take control, wreak havoc, do what they want, do what they please. And, you know, the people who are really suffering are the local communities. And so that's why, you know, the humanitarian situation is such a complex issue and such a big issue right now. So when you have something like Ebola that hits on top of that, it really does have a major impact on the situation in the country.
And in your response, what government entities do you work with?
So we're working with the Ministry of Health for the Ebola response and the World Health Organization as well. You know, they've actually been very impressive in their quickness or speediness in terms of responding. And this is the 10th Ebola outbreak in DRC. So they've had some practice and they've had some experience now to kind of hone in, you know, what exactly needs to be done. They vet partners very carefully. So for Mercy Corps to be selected as an organization that can respond to the Ebola outbreak, you know, we had to go through a process where they approved us formally. And so there are very few actors actually that meet the criteria to be able to respond. You know, and that speaks to our work elsewhere where we've done Ebola response, I think, you know, and also our reputation in DRC where we've been a longstanding humanitarian actor.
And what other programs is Mercy Corps involved in DRC?
So in DRC, we have a mix of humanitarian response programming. So when there's an emergency, whether it's a natural disaster like a landslide or a flood, or an emergency that's related to, say, the conflict. So if there's fighting going on in a community and people have to flee, we come in and we support them, support affected people with food, with water, any type of emergency relief programming. We also are doing longer-term development programming. So in certain parts of the country where it's a bit more stable, we're doing things like agriculture, good governance programming. We have a major urban water and sanitation program where we're working on bringing clean water to a city of over 1 million people. So we have a mix of both. And in the areas where the current Ebola outbreak happened, we were primarily doing other emergency programs. So, you know, it is this outbreak has happened in an area where it's prone to conflict. You know, on a regular basis, communities are having to flee conflict or seeking refuge in other communities close by. And so we've been doing a lot of our, we call it rapid response, but it's programming where we go in, do short-term assistance just to help people get by during that period where their communities aren't as safe for them to be in.
And I read earlier that, I don't know if it was today or just recently, but the health ministry declared that they would not be, that Ebola treatment would be available free of charge. And I was a little surprised reading that at first, just to the idea that there would have been a charge for it to begin with.
And so in Congo, unfortunately, the public health services, it's definitely a weak part of the government services that are available. And so they often do charge for basic medical care. But, you know, in a situation like this, typically these services would be available free of charge. So,
And are there any lessons from the West African outbreak of a few years ago that are, I guess, either personally or as an organization that are being applied to this current outbreak?
Definitely. Mercy Corps is, we were a key actor in Liberia in responding to the Ebola a few years back. And I think for us, it's helped us be more prepared as an agency to respond quickly. So within the last 2.5 weeks since the current outbreak was declared in DRC, we've already trained up our entire field teams on prevention, on, you know, general awareness around Ebola, because this is the first time that in this part of the country it's been hit. So, you know, making sure our teams are informed and best prepared of how to respond. And then also programmatically, we have tools available. We have awareness raising materials already available that we can quickly adapt to the context in DRC. So it's helped us definitely be more prepared and then be able to respond as quickly as possible. We've already deployed team members to those areas and they've already started activities around awareness raising and prevention activities. But then also, you know, installing emergency hand washing stations. We've been doing some assessment work as well to make sure that water and sanitation facilities are clean and that they're adequate in those areas that are affected.
This is going backwards a little bit, but background-wise, Ebola originated or was first described in the Congo in 1976, I believe, and as you mentioned, there have been 10 outbreaks since then that are known of in the Congo. What is there anything that makes this one different, or is there anything particular to this outbreak that you haven't seen in previous ones?
Well, the location is definitely, it poses a number of risks, I would say, given the location, given that North Kivu, you know, is a main kind of trading area with both Uganda and Rwanda. Goma, which is really not that far distance-wise mm-hmm. from the northern part of the province, is a major city. And there are definitely sanitation and water issues in Goma. And so if there are cases that end up being reported in Goma, that poses a huge threat, I would say, you know, again, having this spread and spread very quickly. And so, you know, we're contingency planning around that in the case that, there are cases reported in Goma. And, you know, we've seen in, like, the Liberia context and others how quickly this can spread and kind of get out of control. So certainly that's something that we're preparing for. Hopefully it won't happen. You know, the government, the government response, as I had said, has been very, very quick, and they seem to have contained things very well so far. And so we're hopeful that that won't happen. But
okay,
there could be a major humanitarian crisis, you know, if it does get to Goma or crosses the border to any of those bigger trade towns.
On Wednesday, while you're in Portland, there's an event happening through Mercy Corps. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, on Wednesday at noon at our HQ downtown, I'll be giving a public talk on the work that we're doing in DRC and speaking a bit more about the current situation with the Ebola outbreak and the programming that we're doing to respond. So if anyone's interested, we would love to have people come by. Our office is located at the corner of First and Ankeny downtown.
So if any of our listeners are listening to this right now and just really want to do something to help out, where would you point them to?
They definitely could look at our work, and there are different ways that, people can help, and they could take a look at our website, so at www.mercycorps.org, or, you know, again, attend that public event later on this week, and I'm happy to point them in the right direction of, you know, how they might be able to help or support our work.
Okay.
Definitely the Portland community has been very supportive of our work globally, and so we are very appreciative of all of that support. So we're always happy to, you know, receive that when possible.
Yes, before we started talking, we were talking about the sort of support that Mercy Corps lends in these areas and about how... a lot of what you do is based simply on cash and not so much material support. Can you elucidate that a little bit?
Sure. So for Mercy Corps, we, when possible, prefer to do cash programming, which is essentially providing cash assistance to families in need, you know, as part of emergency response. A lot of that has to do with it helps people choose how best to respond to their own needs. So it's not a one-size-fits-all package. One family who's affected by conflict might need to pay for school fees because they're, you know, having to put their children in a new school. Others, it might be to buy emergency food and water. And so giving a family cash gives them that choice. It helps to kind of empower them to be able to meet their needs in the best way possible. You know, it also reduces some of the logistical challenges that we face in many different countries, specifically in DRC. As I had mentioned earlier, there are issues around, you know, physical access to some of the communities that are most affected. So, you know, transporting kits of food and other supplies is really difficult in places like the DRC, whereas we, for cash programming, often partner with a private sector actor to be able to, you know, deliver cash in a safe way that doesn't put people at risk. You know, even in terms of we have a lot of the people that we work with may still be on the move after we support them. So, you know, carrying a bunch of supplies physically can be very taxing. And these are people who are fleeing on foot. Don't, you know, they're not fleeing on cars or so. Transporting cash is more discreet than that, so it puts them at a little bit less risk. Often people think it might put them at more risk, but actually it's more discreet. You know, they might be able to spend some now and save that, you know, a portion of it for later. So again, it it helps us tackle some of those issues that we face in countries like the DRC.
When do you head back to the Congo?
I will be going back in early September. So I've been taking a short break, spending some time with friends and family, And that's what brought me to the Portland area. So I'll be going back shortly.
All right. I've been speaking with Whitney Elmer with Mercy Corps. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman.
Tune in on Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community.